Welcome back to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. Again, I'll be archiving this on my website of www.ReginaldAngusArgue.com. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. I'd like to continue on with our next guest. Before we do that, I just want to tell a listening audience that the song you were listening to is done by Pink. It's called Dear Mr. President. Every time I hear it, there seems to be an awful lot of dust in the air because I'm just thinking all the different young soldiers that have lost their lives in the illegal wars over in Afghanistan and Iraq at this time. Now, with that said, my next guest is the author of Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, and he's co-founder of the WarIsACrime.org, formerly known as AfterDowningStreet.org. With that said, I'd like to introduce David Swanson.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for coming on there, David. I've looked through your different articles, and it's very impressive. The first question I want to ask you, I think many people in the world and even probably people in the United States are thinking, you know, what type of message do you feel that has been sent out to everyone with Clinton almost being impeached over his, you know, misinforming the people and his extramarital affairs in the White House compared to Bush administration's 935 lies leading up to the Iraq War, which has cost trillions of dollars and millions of lives, along with destroying the economies in Iraq and the United States, just to name a few things?
Well, Clinton was impeached, but he was acquitted in the Senate just very narrowly. And I have good friends who are responsible and serious people who thought that, in fact, Clinton should have been convicted since he lied under oath and so forth. And you can certainly make a case for that. But that's holding presidents to a remarkable standard. I thought that Clinton should have been impeached for some of his more serious crimes, including war crimes in Yugoslavia and so forth. But what he was attacked for was a scandal that was generated by an incredibly costly and pointless investigation, and as you note, in comparison to the crimes and abuses of some other administrations that have been passed over, it was absolutely an outrage, and I actually think it's counterproductive and destructive for us to look into the personal and sexual lives of public figures. I think it's none of our business and should have nothing to do with politics. And so I had a lot of problems with what the Congress did with Clinton. But that being said, there's hardly a crime that Bush and Cheney engaged in that President Obama is not engaging in at the same level or worse. And there is absolutely no talk of impeaching President Obama, at least for any serious grounds. And there was a massive movement to impeach Bush. We had a majority of the public in support of it. We had articles of impeachment introduced. We had intense lobbying efforts. We just couldn't get any action out of the United States Congress.
Yeah, and I'm also, you know, I support what you're just saying because, you know, there's many crimes that the Clinton administration was guilty of. We have to remember at the same time Waco and other instances where, you know, action was taken out against the American people. So it's same done with Bush, you know, in regards to an awful lot of memos he passed. But with that said, you know, how much damage do you feel that the Bush administration, who once said that the U.S. Constitution is a G.D. damn piece of paper, how much damage do you think he's done to the U.S. Constitution? And the question is, can the American people ever repair it?
Well, I don't know if he actually made that remark. It comes from one source that has not proved reliable, but it certainly characterizes his attitude and that of many other people in Washington at that time and before and since. We had our current president some months back stand in front of the Constitution in the National Archives and tell us we would no longer have habeas corpus. We would formalize a policy developed by Bush of locking people up without any charge, and we have done so. The damage done by any presidential administration with the complicity of the Congress and the people and the media and the states and so forth is, you know, it can be incredibly damaging. But what long-term damage it does is determined primarily by the administration and the Congress that comes next. And we could have had the president who came after Bush undo his abuses and prosecute his crimes and put people in prison and deter the repetition of those behaviors and really treat Bush and Cheney as an aberration, which is how a lot of people, at least people loyal to the Democratic Party, still see them. Or we could have had what we ended up getting, and that was someone who comes in after Bush and Cheney and really formalizes and cements in place as official policy many of the crimes and abuses that they creatively came up with, which is incredibly damaging because the history through the past couple of centuries is one where when one president develops a new power and the next administration continues it unchallenged, the Supreme Court from then on treats that as now a new presidential power.
And also, at this time, I noticed one of your articles that you're writing about 46 congressional candidates opposing the war spending. Could you tell us a little bit about what this war spending bill is and how it's going to be used in the Afghanistan war?
Well, we're now at 50. Four more have come in since this morning. I'm collecting a list of candidates for Congress this year who are campaigning as part of their platform that they oppose any more spending on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we have lots of national organizations signed on, about 18 of those, and 50 candidates fairly evenly split three ways between Democrats, Libertarians, and Greens, with a few independents thrown in. Not a single Republican yet, but we're trying. And we're going to build that list, which is at warisacrime.org, as one tool for pressuring our current Congress, because the polls show that a majority of Americans don't want this war in Afghanistan at all, much less escalating it. And here comes a bill through Congress to put $33.5 billion into escalating, sending more troops into Afghanistan against the will of the American people, the Afghan people, the law, and the wisdom of the experts in the military itself. And yet it looks like this is going to go through. There are a couple of ways it could run into trouble. One is that there's a Republican senator, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who has said he will filibuster, not because he objects to war, but because he objects to spending money outside the budget with these phony so-called emergency supplemental spending bills. If we could cut spending somewhere else, including waste in the Pentagon, he would be happy to pay for the war. He just doesn't want it done off the books, cheating the budget. The other place it could run into trouble is in the House, because all the Republicans might vote no. Not because they object to the war or spending money, but because they object to good things that might be put into the bill along with the war. So if there's significant money for U.S. teachers in schools to avoid laying them off, and Republicans all vote no because of that, and they're happy to do that and ignore all the nonsense about you're not supporting the troops and so forth that always scares the Democrats, well, then we only need 39 or 40 Democrats to vote no to stop the bill. And then, of course, pass the good things, the school funding and everything else, separately without the war funding. And there is a distinct possibility of making that happen. So people should be phoning their representatives in the House and demanding that they vote no on another $33 billion to escalate an unpopular war, and not just demanding it and not just expressing disappointment or concern, but promising them that you will vote against them in November if they keep voting all of our money for wars. Because any other issue that you care about isn't going to go anywhere if all of the money goes into the wars.
And also, I printed out a pamphlet today that you had called the Strip the Lipstick Off the Pig, and there's two phone numbers there for a listening audience who comes listening in from the United States. I wanted to quickly share the two phone numbers that the American listeners can call. One is a Senator Kerry, 617-565-8519, and then there's Senator Brown, 617-565-3170. And could you tell us a little bit about this Strip the Lipstick Off the Pig?
Well, those are a couple of Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate. I'm not sure what the phone calls to them were about. This is I post lots of articles and flyers and blogs written by other people. I think this was a flyer put together by a guy named Cole Harrison, who's heading up the Afghanistan working group within United for Peace and Justice. But the theme of stripping the lipstick off the pig is of course, a very important one, and what we were just talking about, and the pig being the $33 billion more for an unpopular war, something that might prove difficult to pass in the Congress, at least on its own. And so the fight right now in the Rules Committee in the House is over whether they can have a vote just on that money alone, or they can only have it in combination with a million other things, including aid to earthquake victims in Haiti, aid for flood relief in the United States, for victims of hurricanes, for victims of tornadoes, for victims of every disaster known to man, except for the war, of course. But even aid for U.S. veterans from the Vietnam War still suffering from Agent Orange, and a little bit of foreign aid and all kinds of goodies in there, and potentially $23 billion to prevent layoffs of teachers in U.S. schools at the state level. If all of that stuff is put in the bill, then you will have Congress members quite disingenuously pretend that they can't vote against it because they don't want to vote against those good things. That's one of many common excuses. And you have Congress members now out there advertising that they want that excuse, publicly saying that, well, I would like to vote no, but if the leadership puts all this other good stuff in there, then I'll vote yes. Sort of publicly making clear what it will take to buy them off.
Yeah, and also, I just wanted to quickly point this out. Today, there was an article that was passed over to me by the people, the War Resister Committee. And what it was from the U.S. Today, and it's titled, In Canada, Once More, U.S. Troops Fleeing the War. And what happens is there's about 200 war resisters in Canada right now seeking sanctuary. It must be new day with my lips, probably. What happens is there's a private member bill in the federal Canadian Parliament. It's called Bill C-440, which calls on our government to stop deporting U.S. war resisters and allow them to become permanent residents of Canada, which I fully support. We'll begin second reading in the House of Commons. Now, what happens, I call upon all the listening audience right now, whether you're from the United States or Canada, you know, find out who the members of Parliament are for our federal Canadian Parliament. Go on the internet, look up their names, start sending them emails in support of allowing these war resisters to stay here. One gentleman is just up the street from our studio, Rodney Watson. He's sitting in the First United Church right now. He cannot step foot off the First United Church property. What will happen is he'll be arrested and he'll be deported. He has a young child here. He just got married. And that's the kind of message that the government wants to send. And there's also Jeremy Heinzman is at this time. He's going before a basically hearing to see whether he's allowed to stay here in Canada or he's going to be sent home. So I just wanted to quickly raise that note. And what is your thoughts on the war resisters allowed to stay here in Canada?
I completely agree with you. Couldn't agree more. Americans are and have been grateful to Canada to the extent that it has served as such a sanctuary, just as we're grateful to prosecutors in Italy and Spain who pursue the crimes of U.S. officials that our own justice system allows to pass by. I think that the United States is in very, very bad shape internally and needs all the help it can get from our neighbors around the world. And this is one thing that Canada can do. We every individual in any military in the world has an absolute duty to disobey illegal orders. And for at least 50 years, that has been understood in international law. And the excuse of following orders was dismissed at Nuremberg, as it should have been. And we have resistors in the United States who are refusing illegal orders directly, and in some cases going to jail, and some of them have served those terms and been released. But those who have been unable to do that and have gone AWOL are in at least one sense refusing to follow illegal orders, and any order to send a soldier into Iraq or Afghanistan or any other foreign occupation is an illegal order. We ought to be applauding these heroes. We ought to be honoring their sacrifices, as we always call it. And to the extent that Canada can help, we are very, very grateful. I know it's a big fight in Canada, and things may turn sour, but we hope that they don't.
And also, there's another question I'd like to ask you. What can the people of the United States do in order to stop this imperial presidency and at the same time return the power back to the Congress and back to the people of the United States underneath the U.S. Constitution?
Well, it would be very helpful, I think. This is something I haven't given a lot of thought to before, but it would be very helpful, I think, if the Canadian government were routinely addressing itself to the United States government in the way that the United States Constitution calls for, but current practice forgets, and that is to treat the United States Congress as the body that makes the laws. Within the United States, it's become accepted that presidents write laws, rewrite laws, violate laws at their whim, determine spending, determine wars, and it's something that's become accepted across the political spectrum and within the Congress itself. And it's extremely dangerous, as the people who wrote our Constitution 2.25 centuries ago fully understood. So if those abroad with voices that can penetrate the U.S. communication system were addressing Congress as the body that makes relevant decisions on international policy, on trade relations, on military decisions, on environmental regulations, and so forth, rather than speaking to the president as if he is a legislator, I think it could be very helpful, and it could cause some eyebrow raising within the United States as newspaper readers try to figure out what they're reading.
And I remember before, my wife and I would spend some time down in the United States, almost 5 years, and there's actually three branches of the government. It's not just the president, it's the three branches that the students are taught at a young age. And it's amazing how so many people elsewhere, like they're saying, they're just noticed there's the president, right? So you're also involved with the other projects at the same time. And one project that you're involved with is called StopTheChambers.com. Could you tell us quickly a little bit about that? We only have a couple minutes left, and then we'll get your contact information so that we can pass it on to the listening audience too.
Sure. Stop the Chamber, singular. StopTheChamber.com refers to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and there are these Chamber of Commerce organizations all over the United States, and many of the small local and state-level ones are not really such forces of destruction in our country. Some of them are quite responsible organizations, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington, D.C., is the biggest funder of lobbying, of corrupting corporate financial influence within our government, the biggest spender of money on advertising on political issues and on advertising on political candidates, which recently our Supreme Court, that third branch of the government, eliminated all limitations on. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce serves as a front group and creates subsidiary, pleasantly named front groups for spending corporate money, so that oil corporations and military and other corporations can spend money to influence U.S. politics without their name being on it. It's an incredibly destructive force with a very right-wing agenda, fighting the idea that global warming exists, prolonging wars, destroying rights for people in the workplace in this country, opposing health care, opposing financial reform, and so forth. And so the influence of that one organization, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, that spends tens of millions of dollars every year to corrupt our government, is something that has to be addressed.
And I wanted to quickly point out there, David, that another website you have is davidswanson.org for people to go check out. Could you leave us with some contact information there, David, for the listening audience so they can contact you if they have any questions they want to ask that we didn't cover today?
Well, that'd probably be the best place. Go to davidswanson.org and click contact and send me an email. And I'd be very interested in anything you have to say. Americans are usually not interested at all and therefore don't learn much about what anyone outside of their country thinks of them. And so I'm eager to hear.
Well, I must say that, you know, in order for me to find out about the true history of Canada, I learned it from the United States. I learned it once access to the internet down the United States. There's an awful lot more information available about Canadian, true Canadian history than I was ever taught when I was in the military for almost 9 years, when I grew up in the northern tip of Vancouver Island, a small town called Port Hardy, and even after leaving the military, I learned an awful lot more down in the United States in almost 5 years than I ever learned here in Canada in regards to Canadian history.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm sure it would work the same if I moved up there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on there, David. That is David Swanson. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. And thank you for listening in. Again, I'll be archiving this on www.reginaldangusargue.com. Thank you, everyone.